So we are looking at heart-centered meditation. And the last talk was on the forgiving heart, the heart of forgiveness. And it's very important to understand what it is that keeps us so disadvantaged spiritually. And the mind almost deliberately sets out to keep us separated and distinct and very different from what the meditation instruction and what spiritual methods in general are attempting to do, which is to unify us within the moment. So we just basically talk very pragmatically about what the meditation or what the spiritual journey is. Spiritual journey is to abide fully within the living experience of now. And the mind, by its nature, it's not an antagonistic creature. It's just one that has learned evolutionarily to maintain a certain perspective on the present moment so that it can have a warning system and a way to flee that moment if it becomes too fearful and threatened. So, you know, as we have evolved through our evolution, we have learned to maintain that sense of subjective and objective experience, even though much of the threat of why that evolved into our makeup is no longer there, still the mechanism is still there. And you might say then that the spiritual journey is to overcome the evolutionary response to threat. Oh, well, that doesn't mean that we then become naive and start walking in bad neighborhoods expecting God to protect us. That's not what it means. And I hope tonight we can begin to see that not only do we have to give up something, but we also get something. We get a discerning clarity that allows us to perceive threat without having to hold that subjective, objective experience of threat prematurely. But so the lack of forgiveness that we had talked about last week is really one of the ways, the tools the mind uses to keep us sort of extended out from the moment, right? So that we're leaning back into time, thinking about what we have done, our remorse, regret, or shame. It's that leaning experience, that sense of reflection upon our life and how awful our lives or we have been within our lives or people have done to us or whatever it might be. But it's that pausing, reflective glance backward that keeps us outside of the here and now, does it not? And as we learn how to forgive, and many of the tools, may I say, in spiritual work have to do with releasing the need to have to think ourselves into the future or the past. That's really the basics of what any spiritual journey is about. We could take a simple Buddhist point of view like, desire creates suffering. Desire creates suffering because desire is something that the moment doesn't contain, and I'm looking for something outside of the moment to enhance this moment, and that difference between what the moment holds and what I want the moment to hold is the definition of suffering. So when the mind protracts itself, extends itself beyond the here and now, to try to recover what it has done in the past or to project and discover something that it needs in the future, then ultimately that extension is going to lead towards some pain and suffering in ourselves. So what we're doing is kind of cleaning up the mess in spiritual work. We spilled ourselves all outside. And now we have to figure out how to clean up the mess and come back properly aligned with the only true instance of our aliveness, and that's here and now. It's not as if we actually live anywhere else, it's just that we pretend to through our thinking. And one of the ways that we do that is through the lack of forgiveness. So we have to clean up that mess. It's just one of the spills. Every class I teach here has to do with one of the spills or another. But we're looking at that particular one. So we do that. And as we do that, what we find is that energetically, we have less thoughts, fewer remuneration about different time zones than the one that we're actually in. We get quieter, in other words, right? Because we're not thinking so much about what we've done or how awful we've been. So you can also see why self-acceptance is so important. Because when we aren't fully present, because we don't think we are deserving to be present, we don't feel completely comfortable within the present because we're constantly questioning our potential to arrive here and now, whether we're up to the here and now and all of that, you can see that that projected burden and distance that we have will keep us out of the here and now. So we have to clean that all up. See, we have to do a good scrubbing here. And as we do so, something really phenomenal happens. We start showing up for our life. Because if we're not thinking away from it, we're living it. Those are the only two possibilities there are. And so it's not as if we have to do something forcefully to come back into ourselves. We have to just give up whittling ourselves away. And we show up because that's where our life is manifesting. That's where our life is manifesting. Now, the way we show up, it's interesting because I just want to go into this a little bit. It doesn't have much to do with the topic, but it will lead into it eventually. Is that most of us start with some sense of mindful effort to be mindful in the moment. We're bringing consciousness with the sense of me into the moment and kind of lodging ourselves, trying to obtain some foothold in the present through my efforts. That's called mindfulness, being aware of. But I'm bringing myself into the awareness of the moment. So there's the moment, what I'm aware of, and me within there, right? And the me isn't, I'm not really trying to be conscious of it. It's following me in, and what I'm trying to be conscious of is the sense of touch or the coolness of the air or whatever the immediate contact with the experience and the knowing of that experience. That's mindfulness, the knowing of what it is that's happening. But I'm taking myself into the moment. When I'm taking myself into the moment, I'm taking thought into the moment because I, the sense of I, is composed of thinking. So mindfulness corrals the sense of thought into the moment. And that's why we struggle so hard to stay there because we keep thinking and then when we get lost in thought, we're out of it. And so we're in this kind of struggle between the thinking mind, which we've incorporated into mindfulness, and the awareness that we're trying to be present of in the moment, and those two are really in conflict with one another. So then as we begin to quiet down through forgiveness, through allowance, through all the different remedies that we encourage each of us to participate in, and we stop struggling and we find, you know, that all of that. What happens is that we start becoming aware or finding ourselves being aware naturally. Just almost blindsided, we notice that awareness is a kind of a natural phenomenon. And we're not trying, we're just being present. And we find that it sort of serendipitously unfolds, not through our effort. And so this awareness becomes a kind of evolution for mindfulness. Not trying so hard, I'm not manipulating, although that mindfulness is, for most people, a phase. It's not to be discouraged, but it's a phase. We move on, and we come into awareness. And awareness has a greater extension, a greater depth, a greater uniformity, an ease, sort of unburdened of self-induced. It's not self-induced. And it really feels much more participatory in our life. But we still claim reference, even within awareness, most of us claim reference to being aware. Well, that's It's an evolution. It's an evolution. And then the final phase is the phase of presence. Presence. Presence is abiding awareness, abiding in awareness, where the sense of self isn't sort of hovering around the moment, but is actually fully invested in the moment. And then when we fully invest in the moment, we have to be very quiet because we're not thinking ourselves outside of the moment. And that full extemporaneous and spontaneous eruption of life living itself is the full embodiment of the spiritual journey. Now, something I want to point out here, which does have something to do with the talk, is that at that point of presence, where I am not the center of presence, presence has a penetrating depth to it. And we begin to see a sense, we get a sense of a commonality of being, a common denominator of being. Common denominator of being. Always before, because I was struggling to come into the moment and doing what I needed to access the moment, that commonality of being was not fully perceived. But as things line up, as the sense of self quiets, you see, when you're, as the moment lines up to itself, as life lines up to itself, it goes a vertical drop in depth. And that vertical drop in depth is not about me at all anymore. It's like a tuning fork to the common note of the universe. And then it's infinite depth of all beings. It's very difficult to speak about, but a sense, as I said, of the groundlessness and unification of all things. Not in thought. Remember, we've given thought up. This is an absolute resonance. It's as clear when we perceive that as hopefully I am sitting here and you're sitting there is clear to you now. It's not a question. It's not like a deliberation. It's not fuzzy. It's absolutely certain. And with that, there's a complete governance of one within the moment, realizing that it makes no sense at all to journey outside for any other existence which can only and always be found here and now. Okay. So that's the preamble to the talk. And the talk tonight is on the intuitive heart. Because one of the aspects of growth as we move from mindfulness to awareness to presence is a growing depth of intuition within ourselves. Now first we have to understand what we mean by intuition. Because every one of us have an idea and love to think that we are very intuitive. But I would suggest that what most of us think of as intuition is really picking up subtle feelings or kind of below the level of obvious thought, perhaps some subtle feeling or sensation that gives us a sense of something different than the normal perceptions that we hold in our usual life. Just as an example of what most people think to be too intuitive, when Ellen and I, my wife and I, were house hunting some years ago, we would go into homes and we always had this sense and whether the home felt, what it felt like as we entered, and whether that in itself was an invitation to stay further and to do further discussions around the house. I just remember one home in particular, both she and I, we walked up to the doors in the Green Lake area, a nice area of Seattle, and a nice home, looked really nice, inside looked nice. We walked in the door, and both of us just felt this jolt, and it was almost, both of us kind of cringed inside, and we just did one loop around, walked right out, God, we got to get out of here, almost picking up energetically the home, something about it. And most of us, that's what we think. Well, that is an intuitive sense. Well, that I'm not discouraging that. I think it's as the senses become more awake, they do pick up subtle senses of energetic senses, drifts and things that the gross mind doesn't normally see. But that's not what I'm calling tonight, the intuitive. And if we just look at it, you see, to rely on these subtle emotions any more than we rely on the obvious emotions, or these subtle thoughts any more than we rely on the obvious thoughts, doesn't make much sense. Equally suspicious, we have to be equally suspicious of any way that we move in accordance with thought or emotion as our basis of understanding. Because it's reactive. Often. I mean, sometimes it's not, and sometimes it is in alignment with a objective truth of what's out there in terms of hostility or energy or whatever. But often it's just a subjective reaction, that conditioned reaction on a more subtle level, which isn't to be taken any more seriously than any other reaction of mind or body. Right? So, but this subtle feeling gets a lot of play this day and age, as some kind of esoteric sort of spiritual sense. But really, when you understand what the intuitive heart is, you see right through that. It's something else entirely. So what is it? Now, remembering what I was saying about abiding in presence and that lining up of the corridors or of the linkages so that there is a complete uniformity all the way down to the infinite existence, where the mind is in stillness and quietude. And from that sort of a pipeline through the hearts of all hearts, there can arise, and there does arise, not can, there does arise spontaneity, creativity that has no obvious source. Right? Where does the creative response come from? Where does spontaneity come from? Well, it doesn't come from the sense of me thinking about something. It comes from the alignment, the quieting alignment. You see, if you think of it as pipes that, I'm trying to get into the moment and we can't, and the pipes don't line up. They just, I'm trying to get into the moment and the moment, is like I'm chasing it. But every once in a while, as we relax and aren't thinking about getting into the moment, we are in the moment, the pipes line up and the spontaneity shoots through. Or a creative moment of thought comes through the mind, not as thought, but then the thought gathers it together in information and expounds upon it. And then we think, oh, I just had a claiming reference and claiming ownership to something. That's the intuitive. That's the intuitive. And may I say that the intuitive requires being quiet. It doesn't require more effortful noise. It requires the willingness just to sort of take ourselves out of things for a moment. I had a very good friend who was a hospice nurse, and she was amazing, just uncanny in her ability to foretell when somebody was going to die. She would say, I would say, I'm going to go out there tomorrow and see her, if we had the same patient that we were working with. And she'd say, well, she'll be dead by this afternoon, Rodney. And I said, no, man, she was walking around. Sure enough, she'd be dead that afternoon. Or she would say she'd be dead before midnight, or she'd be dead by the weekend. And every single time, and I just got, it was uncanny. I mean, it was eerie how how she was doing this. So I said, okay, Kathleen, I want to see how you do this. Start. What do you look at? She says, I don't know. She said, well, I said, well, put some effort into recognizing what you're doing, because I want that too. So she tried. She said, okay, I'll see what I'll write it down. She got into this thing. And then the whole thing got skewed. She would say he was going to die on Tuesday and the man would be alive for another 2 weeks. I mean, she was just way off the mark. And she got very upset with me. Yes. Because she said that I had thrown her off. And she didn't know how to get back to it. And so what I had really done was have her focus intellectually on what was coming to her automatically. And she wasn't able to come back into that spontaneous life understanding that she had when she was at the bedside. And she wasn't a particularly intuitive woman outside of her role as a hospice nurse. But my God, when she was in that, the pipes lined up. And there was just this sense of wonder, and that was one of the manifestations of that. And there were times in my hospice career where I would just be driving down the street and I'd think, oh, I should stop and see Mr. Jones. Just from nowhere it would come. So I would stop and go in, and sure enough, Mrs. Jones was having some kind of tragic or some occurrence had happened, and the patient was dying or some emergency was happening. So I would do that two or three times, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. Maybe I'm just coming at it in a different way. So then I'd be driving down the street and I'd say, okay, well, I bet Barbara needs to see me. So I'd pull over and Barbara says, what are you doing here? You see, and so I couldn't, and I kept trying to get it mentally all lined up. It doesn't work that way. So let me save you the hassle. It's actually a beautiful heart resonance. And the reason we're talking about the heart in this series is because those are the pipes. It's the heart. It's the synchronicity of heart. And heart, I don't mean the organ, although it's better to think of it as being somewhere outside of the mind so that you won't look up to the mind as a way to kind of bring those pipes in alignment. But the heart is just what's left when we're quiet, when there's stillness. And the richness of the wonder that's there when we're not constantly inscribing the moment with our thoughts. And interestingly enough, when the heart does arise, not through the will of the mind, but through the natural release of the tensions of life, because the tensions of life is where thought coalesces around us with the unforgiveness, right? That's a tension of life. So unforgiving, and we just constantly loop out with our thinking around those unforgiving moments. But as those heal, those loops quiet, and what's left after the tensions have been released is the heart. And the heart contains all the qualities that you so wish for yourself. That's the thing. It's not something, we don't have to go on a scavenger hunt to become caring and loving and patient and kind. That it's withheld within the wonder, held within the mystery itself. That's the fabric of the mystery. That's the manifestation of the mystery itself. Now, I want to just encourage using the body as the intuition central rather than the mind. I just don't think that if you start up here, you can start anywhere because it's all the same and the depth of what I'm speaking about. But the body holds an intelligence that we have not fully invested in. And that intelligence, we think all of the mind, all the organism's intelligence is up here in the mind somewhere. It's not like that at all, really. I mean, if you look at some of these transplant patients where they have one heart is given to another patient, and that patient, the transplant recipient, develops the tastes of the person who's is dead and had the heart previously, or meets people that they now know almost in accordance with how that other person, the dead person, met the person and felt about them. Anyway, there's much more going on in the body than we give it relevance. And it really has a dimension in our sitting practice that I'd like to encourage. As I was speaking about last week, and for those of you who weren't here, when you're sitting, you're just being still with yourself, you see. The mind is babbling, and for everyone that's probably the case. But the context, the shell around all of that is really being held in the steady attention of body. And the body is the holder of all of this noise. And as the body relaxes with that noise and doesn't invest in struggling with the thought, but just allows the thought to settle on its own, space opens up. Space. And I would call that physical space, even though it feels very mental. The body opens up as well. The body isn't as dense or tight or contracted. It really feels much more expansive. And that sense of confidence that the body can give us as the mind does what it's doing, and we just take up residence in the body and let the mind go wherever it goes, and we just sit quietly with steady certainty in the body, and that intelligence begins to trump what the mind thinks is so important to do. It's what the poem was trying to say, I think, by E.E. Cummings when he says, I can't remember it, but it was about the bird and that knowing that sound. Anyway, I can't remember it. They take my poem away so quickly, I can't. Anyway, so in any case, the body holds this confidence, this intelligence that we don't, we really don't credit. And I think so much of the sitting practice allows us to re-encourage that sense of bodily intelligence back into ourselves so that we can hold the confidence within the form rather than just doing whatever the mind tells us to do. Okay? So that's an access to the intuitive. That's a touching point into the intuitive. When I was, I'm just telling some hospice stories tonight. One of them was that I was with a woman whose mother was dying, and I was sitting there speaking to the daughter, who is a grown woman, and I was looking over her shoulder and I could see her mother, who was the hospice patient in the hospital bed, facing me as I was speaking to the daughter of the patient. And as I was speaking, the phone rang and the daughter got up and went to the phone to answer it. And as she left, I had a clear view of the patient right in front of me. And the patient, I could sense, was actively dying. So I stood up and I turned to the daughter to tell her that her mother was dying, and my body just wouldn't go there. It wouldn't take a step towards the daughter. I didn't know why it wasn't, but it would go towards the patient. So I went where it would go and I went to the patient's bedside. I held her hand. And as the daughter was speaking to someone on the phone, her mother died. She gets off the phone, and I go over to the phone thinking I was going to get scolded for not getting her off the phone, and I tell her that her mother had just died while she was on the phone. She said, oh, thank God I wasn't with my mother. She wouldn't have wanted me to be there, and I would have broken down. So I don't know where that came from, or how that was known. You see, it's not, if you're like me, you keep wanting to process it up here to get some pragmatic way that we can recreate this script. Because it's so amazing when it does happen, and we dismiss it so easily from the mind's point of view. Oh, you just made a good guess. Right? No. When you feel it, it holds the confidence of the body. It's not just a good guess. There's a resonance with what you're doing that is the only thing you can do in some ways. Now, so you have to be careful here, because then you start thinking, well, you know, the son of Sam, you know, he thought he was doing what the universe wanted him to do, and he started, is he the one that shot Reagan? Yeah, okay, so God told him to, or the devil told him to, or somebody told him to. So was that the intuitive working through him, you see? And well, how's that different than me not going to the, I mean, is that, you know, is that all? Okay, so this is where we bring back in discernment, wisdom. There's an integrity factor here that's beautiful to see, because it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't allow a manipulation of the moment. It doesn't allow, because there's no thought, because it's quiet, it's not self-induced. It's not me kind of looping around in my own thinking, creating some kind of paranoid response or some kind of, it's not self-generated through thought. So that avenue is not there. And what is there is a benevolence of spirit. A caring presence that doesn't have any need or relationship to manipulation at all. It's not in the picture. And when that is turned over, the discernment, the wisdom factor, it just does the appropriate thing given the spontaneous eruption of the moment. And that is the intuitive heart, my friends. And if that doesn't lure you into this practice, what will? Because our actions of body, speech, and mind are the manifestation of the whole, not from the part. And most of us have lived piecemealing our actions of body, speech, and mind. And the whole of the Dharma is to bring this together in uniformity, integrated, not as a separate piece any longer. Now, what blocks intuition? What blocks that? I want to know, right? So we can start working. Much of what we've already talked about is the way that we keep giving ourselves away in the moment to sort of shore up our sense of self-image as a way to keep us contained within the same self-description that we've always been. And we have to keep telling ourselves what we are in the moment to be what we are in the moment, because when we're quiet, we're not that. So we have to bring noise into the moment so that we can reaffirm the image that we're taking with ourselves in the present, bringing with ourselves into the present. That takes a lot of strength, takes a lot of tension, and it takes a lot of self-talk. And that self-talk refuses to acknowledge or allow that infinite dimension, because it's a bottomless dimension. And that's scary to the image of me. So I'll talk myself into a false bottom and into a false moment through that false bottom, because I'm so afraid of what would happen if I just free fell. If I allowed myself to release from that tension and just free fell. And you can see the extremes. You can see how some people are so dogmatic and so ideological and so opinionated and so full of views that they can't allow any possibility of there being any momentary crease in the floor of their certainty. No cracks allowed. I have to know something about everything and pronounce it, assert it. And we say that's a clear mind, somebody who's opinionated. That they're clear. Oh, look how many opinions he has. He knows all, everything. I see that's a fearful mind. They're afraid to release their image even for a second. And therefore, we have to bring ourselves into everything. Our need for certainty, our need for conclusion, which is a constant referencing from the old evolutionary expression of the mind. I need to be certain about where I am and where all the animals are in the forest and who's a friend and who's a and all of that. I can't take a step into the night. But we've outlived that evolutionary response. That's the thing. It's time now to come back. You see, every step was, we were talking about mindfulness and awareness and presence, and these are just, I'm just making these up. I mean, they have some connection to the actual evolution of practice, but at each step, there's something that is validated and something that is expanded in our life. Even at the step of mindfulness, not even, but at the step of mindfulness, when we are asserting our own volitional awareness upon something, this relationship, this conscious relationship that we now have to the world begins to expand our openness, our understanding, our self-allowance, self-love. It begins to expand our, eliminate some of the unconscious reactive tendencies in us. Our world starts opening. And so then as our world starts opening and we align ourselves properly in arrangement, then we come into the next phase of awareness, which is not so self-induced, and the world expands even further. But the circumference is still there. I mean, the center is still there. So the circumference is expanding, but the center is still there. Now when we come into presence, the center is gone. And with no center, there's no circumference. You see? So it's not to say that mindfulness or the evolution or permutations of mindfulness is wrong. It's just center-related. Our world expands because it was all center before. There wasn't even any circumference. Now, as we expand into the evolutionary phase, that things open up, space. We have more room, more maneuverability. We aren't as conditioned as we used to be. If this happens, we don't have to respond with A with B. And that feels wonderful. It feels light. And many of us rest there. But that's a far different universe than centerless universe. And where space is infinite, not protracted. Not distant. There's no distance now. In which every expression of life is spontaneous living. And then we look back and we, why do we need, what do we what comes in when we release the need to be certain and secure? What comes in when we release the need for certainty is something that we can never know as long as we want to grasp onto certainty, because they're counterindicated. What comes in when we release the need to be certain is discernment. We don't become naive, you see. It's not as if we lose our ability to have knowledge, to do. There's a beautiful story of another hospice nurse. I seem to be moving in hospice directions tonight. She was a very spunky aide, and she was in our home care. She was in our inpatient unit. And, you know, she would do things like one time. No, she was an LVN. That's what she was. She was an LVN. So one time she was having this conversation with the woman patient, and the patient was in a lot of fear, and Andrea just got in bed with her, despite all of the training that she'd ever had in her nursing and her medical field, which was never to do that. She knew that that's what the woman needed. And she would keep doing things like that. But they're always, when you heard it, you go, yes, absolutely. I'm glad you did that. It was like, you know that feeling like, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That absolute sense of rightness. That's what it is. See, that's where the pipes are aligned. Where the heart knows itself. With its own certainty, where it isn't second-guessing itself, where it isn't questioning its own relevance. We're questioning our relevance all the time. Well, should I be doing this or what? What about, you know, am I up to this? Or how can we be aligned with anything when we aren't aligned with ourselves? As you see the work we have to do, but don't postpone it because it seems insurmountable. It's not. Once that's the trick of the mind, to delay tactic. When we start understanding how we can work with this thing, it opens up into, oh, this is... Because it becomes less personal. It doesn't become so tragically my story. It's just, what have I done this for? I didn't need to do this. And we start moving out, not geometrically, not arithmetically. It starts building upon itself, empowering itself, encouraging itself. That's why one of the factors of being together as a Sangha is that power reinforces itself through other, seeing it in other people. You know it in yourself. You go down to your work life, you may never even see it. You never see that, oh yes, that's it, yes, that absolute rightness. But you hang around people who are, their pipes line up quicker. Oh, I see, So how to work with the intuitive? A good mantra: add nothing to this experience. Add nothing to it. Our need to add something to it is quite likely pleasure-seeking or because of a fear relationship. Or just let the experience be what it is. Add nothing to the experience. Then we will be completely inclusive and allow the experience to come in. If you add something, you're negotiating and you're keeping it out. Let the experience in and feel the certainty. The body has the courage, it has the intelligence and capacity to hold the experience that you allow in. Once we allow the experience in and we realize we have that capacity and that calm certainty that comes with knowing that you can hold the mind, whatever the mind might do, then we have to be careful that we don't personalize what's going on in there. This is not about me. Add nothing to this experience, and this is not about me. And so then, when it's not about me, we'll let the experience go. When the movement and flow of life goes uniformly through us, like waves that have no partition or no block, there's no resistance against the waves, the pipes are lining up. Now that's very different, and I just want to be cautious, because I've also seen people who are so flighty, so ungrounded, that anything new, they're just often, anything, and that's not what we're talking about. There's an intelligence here that's accessed. A great intelligence that's not yours or mine, but is there for all of us to join. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? You see, the way of the heart. This is the way of the heart. And as we have mentioned in other times, these two paths, the way of the heart is the message of this series. Many of you are heart-centered people, and your path is the way of the heart. For others, it's the path of wisdom. And those two meet and join at a certain stage in practice. But come through the heart chamber, if that is your way. Step into it. Invite it in, and invite it in absolutely, unconditionally. All it needs is for you to begrudge what it means to be kind or something, or some flinch, and the whole thing breaks down like that. What would it be like? To live in that. Quiet certainty. So, if any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to try to respond. Yes.
It's easiest for children and
pets. Yes.
To just have that sense of just being able to go with them.
Yes.
And it seems that maybe I have much less story with all of that. I'm not thinking about
with pets and children. Yes, yes, good.
That if I can just be
yes.
More spontaneous.
Yes. I think that's a good summation. She said that when she's with pets and children, she sees a more of an ease, a spontaneous ease, than with adults or whatever. And if you look at it just logically, there's much more projection and restraint with adults. And there's also much more projection in the sense that they're thinking this about me and all the conclusions, and then each of those thoughts produce a kind of tension within us, which keeps us from that spontaneity as we sort of find a way in to be accepted. Often it has to do with acceptance, because We are trying to have someone else offer us what we have never been offered as a child or ourselves as an adult. That sense of unconditional acceptance, which a pet can do. And when we are offered unconditional acceptance, like a child or a pet, that can bring forth that unconditional acceptance of us within that relationship as well. When I was a monk in the forests of Thailand, I really wasn't bothered by the Thais because I couldn't speak Thai. And so they would go on and I would just, you know, I really didn't have much of a relationship. And so my relationship was really with the forest. And it was very authentic, very natural, and very warm-hearted. But then a Westerner from some other monastery would come and visit, and I could just feel my heart just contract. And what's he doing here? You know, like, this is my monastery. And so you begin to see that you have to go towards where the contraction is. And you can't stay in the forest. It'd be lovely, you know, but there's more of life than the forest. And you go where you're contracted, where it's hard. So you go to the adult world, and it always has to do with what we do to ourselves in relationship to that other object, person, or thing, not what they're doing to us, right? How am I holding myself in some kind of contracted way that keeps me from being at ease? What am I saying to myself and believing about what this person wants or I need from them or they need from me or whatever it might be occurring, right? So there's this kind of tension that's almost inherent in relationship. And if you ever have a really good friend, one that goes back, like I have one that goes back to about age 8, and you just, there's none of that, you know, and it doesn't, he doesn't care, you could just say anything, and it's all been said in the 55 years that we've been together. It doesn't make any difference anymore. In fact, the person I'm thinking of is conservative, airline pilot, very opinionated, you know, but doesn't matter. Like another person that I would meet of that could quite likely throw me off track. But him, I mean, I've long since let him be who he was, and he has long since let me be in opposition to who he was. And that works perfectly. And there's, and the ease of that. So I don't ever, there's nothing that is brought to that relationship except just warmth. Now why does it take 55 years to do? I don't think it needs to. But it needs to take inward work. What we do is that we so quickly are thrown back on the pain of our life and then use that as the fact of our existence as we try to manipulate through the pain of what this person in my life means that I have to do about me and what's wrong with me and all of the projected ways that we relate to someone else through the pain of our life. We take that as the truth. We never question that. And so the relationships becomes and really how to go through this relationship and sidestep with as much as I can the pain that is back there that is constantly expressing itself through this meeting. You know, you meet somebody, it's like, I wonder what he thinks of me. Oh, he's frowning. Oh, maybe he doesn't like me. Am I not likable? It's like we're leaning into every moment through our pain, you see. So just standing up, you know, it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. And this isn't a whitewash. It doesn't make any difference what he feels about me. It's the truth. What difference does it make? And that's the access of warmth. That isn't turn you away and cut you off in distance. That is the way you access warmth. It's through it doesn't make any difference. That's not a whitewash. I'm not saying, you don't make any difference in me. No, it's what you're thinking about me doesn't make any difference to me. That's the only way we can access love, isn't it? But we have to do so much work to get to that point where it really doesn't make any difference to me. Right? And that's where most of us get stuck. Yes?
I think I'm maybe slightly confused about the idea of wanting to be certain about this and having that a need for a grounding when there shouldn't be a grounding versus being just naturally curious about something and wanting to know about stuff. And giving opinions in the pursuit of wanting to know about something, is that a demonstration of maybe some deeper need to have some certainty?
No. Curiosity. The question is curiosity a deeper need? Anything can be a neurotic need. You know, anything can have a neurotic a film on it. But the natural interest of the heart towards something, if you look at what the mind looks like when it's really interested, there's no opinion. You're learning about it. You're receiving life, right? You're not informing life. You're not putting your blueprint on. When you're interested, when you're curious, when you're really moving into something like that and soaking it up, your pores, it's like you're opening your pores to life, right? And you're letting it in. And that is really where the Dharma goes. It goes in that direction. It goes less and less in the direction of imprint and more in the direction of receptivity. Now, when I'm talking about the quiet certainty, that's not an intellectual certainty. When we're not neurotic, there's certainty of where our place is on earth is where we are. That's the certainty I'm talking about. Not, I'm really sure I'm supposed to be. No, it's not an intellectual certainty. It's like the ground's under your feet. That's it. There's no argument here. This is where I am because this is where I am. This is where I belong because this is where I am. You see? I'm talking about a different level of certainty than an intellectual certainty. So you're not excusing yourself in any way when you meet someone. We're not in any kind of inward disarray in that meeting. That's the certainty of our own body's intelligence. I'm here. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's a little different than what I think how you might be interpreting it. Right. And within that certainty, there's inquisition and intelligence and interest, and life is flowing in. So the certainty isn't an obstruction or a boundary at all. It's just an absolute knowing. I mean, where else could we be? Yes.
So, I appreciated what you said about sometimes feeling connected to a intelligence, because I know what you mean by that.
Yes. Yes, of course you do.
Heart knowledge.
Yes. Good. Yes.
And I'm wondering how to reconcile those two things, the knowledge that there is something.
Yes. So the intelligence and the emptiness. Right? Because I don't feel, I think she was saying, I don't feel like I understand the emptiness. But I've had times when the intelligence is very acute, it's very present, right? Okay, so now your job is to fully embody that intelligence so that you're not weighing in on it. Wow, that's very interesting. God, I really feel the intelligence. Don't weigh in on it with thought. Don't put anything between you and that intelligence, and you will know simultaneous emptiness within that intelligence as well. We keep the intelligence at bay as an objective thing by having comments. Oh, God, this is really interesting. And all of us have done that when we our meditation. Oh, my God, this is really interesting. Look at this. I can't believe what it's. And what we're doing is actively boundarying and making something very contained. We're containing it. so that it doesn't get too large with our words, right? And most of us have to go through a number of episodes in which we try to contain something so that we know we can contain it without our words. So, after over time, and this is the evolution of practice, over time we learn to bring less and less to things. And that's emptiness, dear. Emptiness isn't something other than the loss of your narrative. And we keep our narrative going in order to fill in the dots. Well, that's a man. Well, that's a bird. And that's a, you know, so we fill in the dots. But what if the dots were just left to be dots? We would also be without form. You see, those two rise together. My need to make those dots into something makes those that thing into a bird. And when a bird is known, I am known as the bird watcher. Those happen simultaneously. When we're no longer invested in infusing words into something, then we become wordlessly shapeless ourselves. Because our words externalized becomes the sense of who we are as the knower of those words. See? So one of the ways that the spiritual journey unfolds is to begin to see that the word doesn't capture the experience. That it's a nice a job, nice attempt, and it keeps us within a kind of dimension in which everybody else is in, but it really doesn't, in its essence, capture the experience. It captures what I remember the experience to be, or it holds it or contains it into a particular idea of something, but it doesn't allow it to be itself. It forms a boundary around everything that we, right? So what does the world look like when I don't force boundaries or force containment on things? Then you'll know your way into emptiness. Does it give you a sense? Okay, thank you for this tonight. And you know what? Happy Thanksgiving to each and every one of you.